There are few individuals for whom the very idea of their existence conjures up a complete set of beliefs and values. Gandhi is certainly one of those. It is remarkable that as India continues to go through its current transformation, that Gandhi's legacy is still evolving. We're going to spend some time talking about Gandhi's extraordinary struggles on two continents, his values, his ideals, and how the nation that still reveres him rejected so many of those values. We're going to talk about it with my guest, Joseph Lilleveld. He is the distinguished former executive editor of the New York Times, a Pulitzer Prize winner for his book about South Africa entitled Move Your Shadow, and it is my pleasure and honor to welcome Joseph Lilleveld to this program to talk about his work, Great Soul, Mahatma Gandhi and his struggle with India. Joseph Lilleveld, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me in.
Delight to have you here. One of the things that is so fascinating to understand about Gandhi is that really to understand everything that happened with him in India, that it's important to understand the 21 years that he spent in South Africa. Talk a little about that.
Well, he gets there at the age of 23. He's already a barrister, a lawyer, trained in England, but he has not been successful establishing himself in a law practice in India. So he's a complete unknown when he arrives, and his task is to serve essentially as a clerk in a case involving some dispute between Muslim traders who have settled in the port city of Durban, who come from his part of Gujarat in India, and he arrives there, and through a series of encounters in the very challenging frontier society in which he was arriving, and in which Indians were really a quite small minority, he begins to evolve into a political figure and begins to have political thoughts. I write that there's no evidence that he had ever had a spontaneous political thought till he got to South Africa. 21 years later, when he leaves, he's a person with a certain reputation throughout the British Empire and that's bounced back to India. He has led a movement. He has evolved his philosophy of nonviolent struggle and resistance. He has gone through a series of transformations in his inner life, what you might call his spiritual life, and has long since he's a father of four. He was married very early at the age of 13, but he has long since taken a vow of celibacy in order to dedicate it himself to a life of public service. He is, except for the fact that he hasn't stripped down yet to dress that we all remember when we think of him in the loincloth and the shawl. He is, for all practical purposes, the Gandhi who would become world known after that. And I try to pursue almost step by step the various intellectual and social pressures that bore on him and that produced this remarkable transformation. And a man who started out in South Africa as an extremely prosperous lawyer. And he goes from being a kind of high bourgeois lawyer to this spiritual political figure, almost unique in his in the way he presents himself to society, all on another subcontinent before he returns home.
Were there some touch points along the way that really were responsible for the way his political views started to evolve? As you say, he was kind of a blank slate going in. Were there specific incidents that really began to turn the tide for him?
Well, there were a number of them, and he laid out some of them in his autobiography. There's the famous encounter when he's thrown off a train going from Durban inland to the capital of the then South African Republic, Pretoria, because a white passenger didn't want to have to share a first-class compartment with what he called a coolie, which was the one of the derogatory names whites used for Indians in South Africa. But I was struck by aspects of his own narrative of his transformation that have not traditionally been emphasized. For me, the dramatic thing of his having been thrown off that train is that he gets back on the same train the next night and is put on in a first-class compartment because he's protested so vigorously. I don't think his instinct to protest was formed in South Africa, but it certainly flourished there. He then had a lot of encounters with evangelical Christians who saw him as a ripe subject for conversion, and it was a kind of spiritual flirtation. He was interested. He went to prayer meetings daily and attended Christian church services, but in the end concluded that in a very ecumenical way that all religious values, all religions preached the same values, and that he could comfortably remain a Hindu by his own lights. He then, as he's due to leave the country, takes on a role of a spokesman for the trading class that I mentioned in Durban, who are being stripped of whatever slight political rights they may have had by legislation in the colonial legislature. And Gandhi begins his remarkable career as a polemicist, writing many letters to newspapers and drafts of petitions to government and pamphlets to try to change white opinion. He's not very successful in changing white opinion, but he's extremely successful in fashioning a voice that other Indians will respond to. And in the course of doing that, he, for the first time, articulates a kind of nationalist philosophy, because these people come from all over India, and they're from various different castes, and then they asked to identify themselves. They may say they're Brahmins or Banyas or Bengalis or Punjabis, and Gandhi understands that in the context of the colonial society where they're a minority, he says the right word, the only word for them is Indian. They're Indians. And it's sort of the first nationalist declaration of his life, the simplest and the purest, and he rallies the community to that standard.
And that was a new aspect for him, because one of the things you talk about is in South Africa is that it was to some extent, and maybe this overstates it, but some extent situational, that there wasn't or didn't seem to be a unifying vision that he had for the country.
No, not for the country. After all, if you think of the demographics of South Africa then and now, the Indians were really the smallest population group. The section of the country where most Indians lived, there were 10 times as many Zulus and other Africans, and whites outnumbered the Indians too. So the politics were pretty raw, because the Africans had yet to assert themselves in political terms and weren't really organized in the modern sense. That was just beginning. And so Gandhi, for his whole time there, was very much an Indian leader rather than a South African leader. Although today, when the post-apartheid government of South Africa, elected by a process of majority rule, one man, one vote, he is now seen rather romantically as one of the founding fathers of the South African struggle.
What do we know about the degree to which Mandela was shaped by Gandhi and his views?
I think Mandela writes about this quite directly in his memoir, and there are a lot of other memoirs and recollections from Mandela's early years. When Mandela emerged as one of the youthful leaders of the African National Congress in the late 40s, he was willing to give nonviolent struggle a try, and they were thinking, they very much had in mind the campaigns Gandhi waged at the end of his time in South Africa, and they were going to try those techniques of struggle against the Afrikaner nationalists, who were at that point imposing the very rigid apartheid regime that went way beyond anything that had been traditional in South Africa. South Africa had always been a racist and segregated society, but it wasn't as rigid in its in its classification of people and its placement of people as it became after the late 1940s. And so the Indians, and this is after Gandhi is long gone from South Africa, it's even after Gandhi's assassination, the Indians and the Africans and some radical and liberal whites all came together in a movement that was known as the Defiance Campaign. Defiance Campaign Against Injustice, I think it was called. And this was around 1951 or two. But Mandela was always very pragmatic in his approach to this, rather than highly principled. He thought that nonviolent struggle should be tried, and if it works, so much the better. But if it didn't work, he made it clear from the beginning that he was prepared to move on to violent struggle, and that's the way things worked out, because the regime proved to be extremely repressive and authoritarian.
When Gandhi comes back to India and he brings with him these ideas of social reform and social equality, in many ways you talk about the fact that they were kind of countercultural to India in so many ways.
Sure, they were. Just for starters, he came up against the whole tradition of untouchability, which is, you know, we have our own history of extreme discrimination and segregation, but it's almost nothing compared to some of the practices that were flourishing in parts of India in the late 19th century and early 20th century. And untouchability, which basically was a condition outside the caste system that's where the word outcast comes from. Outside the caste system, basically included about roughly 20% of the whole population of India. And it meant that caste Hindus felt that they could be polluted. That's the translation of the term they used, polluted by close contact with people from these groups who basically traditionally were seen as the people who did society's dirty work. Dirty work meaning picking up the night soil, was left all over the place in rural and urban India, in picking up dead carcasses of animals, that sort of thing. People who did the dirty work of society were deemed to be untouchable, and that was a form of social inequality that was rigidly pursued, and it, of course, led. It of course meant there was no interdining with lower caste or untouchable people, and of course there was no marriage or mixing of the gene pools with these people. This has remained an issue in Indian life to this day. Gandhi, on his return, was quite revolted by the whole thing, and is wasn't unique in that respect. Other Indians had come to the same conclusions, but he was the first person who took it to a level of mass campaigning.
And talk about that it had gone from initially sort of an elite movement to a mass campaign, to a mass movement, and that he had the impact that he had without really convincing people of the values that he had.
This is a remarkable thing and very hard to understand. Hard to understand at the time, hard to understand in retrospect. Gandhi adopted this persona over a period of 6 or 7 years where his dress changed, his appearance changed. You know, when he returns, this is a society, we're talking about the period of the First World War, and we're talking about a poor colonial society. This is not the mass communications era that we know. Radio did not yet exist. There were most people didn't, by overwhelming majority of people, could not read newspapers. So how did this man become so well known across the whole subcontinent to tens and hundreds of millions of people? It happened, and what they saw in him was a transformational character, who was going to somehow, almost by spiritual force or by magic, change their lives. Huge crowds. By 1920, 21, and 22, huge crowds, 50,000, 100,000, would turn out to hear his speeches. And if they could hear them, because the amplification systems were pretty primitive at that time. But they thought they at least wanted to get a look at this great saintly figure who was going to change their lives. And the simplest way I've found to express what happened was that they saw in him a man who cared for them in a new and different way. I think that it was an image they projected on him as much as what they received from him. What they didn't receive from him in the beginning was a clear, he spoke clearly, but how much of his expression of his values they took in is very open to question in those circumstances.
I mean, in many ways, looking at it from a contemporary perspective, it was clearly a triumph of personality over anything else.
Clearly. And also, you know, it was almost theatrical, almost a trick what he did by stepping out of the conventional clothes a lawyer or a political leader might wear into the clothes the poorest Indian, the garb of the poorest Indian peasants. Gandhi was expressing an identification with the poorest people in the society, and it was a form of image making that had powerful impact because it was so new and so different.
And he would accomplish this, as you talk about, within 5 years of coming back to India from South Africa.
Yeah, about 5 to 6 years. By 1921, he comes back at the beginning of 1915. By 1921, the Congress movement, which was basically the national movement and had not yet split on communal lines as it later did, by communal I mean Hindu-Muslim, basically elected him as their leader and gave him wide-ranging powers to define the program and purposes of the movement and the pace at which it would pursue them.
How did he deal with this reality that he had so much personal power and personal magnetism, and yet was facing such resistance in terms of his values and ideas?
Well, the resistance was supple at first. I mean, his program was endorsed. I think in 1922, for the first time, the Congress movement said that untouchability should be abolished. It endorsed most of his values in the beginning, and endorsed what he called his constructive program, which included village industries, cottage industries, a heavy emphasis on spinning of cotton and hand weaving as an answer to unemployment and of the rural poor, and people started wearing homespun garments because that was considered the patriotic thing to do. But all of this was sort of to please the Mahatma. Mahatma means great soul, and by then he was the Mahatma. And it took a while before it became plain to Gandhi that he wasn't really making progress on these various fronts. He became very close to winning the support of Muslims. It's a complicated story that I go into in the book, by campaigning. It's hard to explain now, but campaigning across India for the restoration of the caliph of the Ottoman Empire. The caliph was the, in a way, the spiritual leader of Sunni Islam, and he was also the sultan of the empire. But the empire was taken apart by the Allied powers after Versailles, and the, you know, it's a complicated history, mm-hmm. and the Turks themselves rejected the Sultan and went off on another path. But Indian Muslims were very much gripped by the idea that the caliphate must be restored, and Gandhi made that a cause of the national movement. There's some sleight of hand in all of this. But for a short time, a year or two, Indian Muslims responded to that, and there was a kind of deal. You know, we'll fight your cause if you'll fight ours. And Gandhi seemed to be, by the force of his own personality and his willingness to straddle all these different causes, seemed to be bringing Hindus and Muslims together. That didn't last. But so in the early years, he felt he was making headway and could through the force of his own personality continue to do so. Then cause by cause, he discovers over the years it wasn't so easy.
And in fact, there's this delicate balance, this contradiction almost in looking at him between the inner life that he had, this spirituality that he thought could help shape the movement, and at the same time, the skills of a hard-nosed practical politician.
Yes, he's many different characters at once, and that's not the whole of it, because Gandhi also campaigned for various forms of non-modern medicine. He was very much into nature cures and mud packs. He campaigned for not just for vegetarianism, which is many Indians are vegetarians, but for particular nutritional programs, which became in some ways keyed to a war he waged, hopeless war, given Indian traditions and Indian reality and human reality against sex. He very much argued that sex should only be for procreation, and almost regretted it when his sons got married. It's He was a very protean figure, and all of this was going on at once, and in his own mind it was one struggle.
To what extent did his personality become something that Indians felt that if they embraced him, if they revered him and embraced the personality, that somehow that gave them a certain spirituality, a certain license in some ways, even to go about the normal course of business, which was very un-Gandhian in some respects?
Well, there is this Indian tradition known as darshan, where to be in the presence of a great spiritual figure is itself cleansing. And I've seen this happen in certain occasions where a figure of some spiritual renown comes before a group of Indians, and they will sit cross-legged and listen to what amounts to a sermon urgently given, and nod their heads, but in a way that seems to indicate they're not taking in anything. The communion is not so much verbal as it is just being there, and certainly a lot of that went on with Gandhi. But there are many influences in India and many spiritual influences, and Gandhi was hardly the only one. But that certainly was part of his appeal.
And as you talk about jumping to the latter part of his life, that after a while he couldn't hold it all together, that things spun horribly out of control.
Well, the movement moved away from him, and the Muslims certainly moved away from him and demanded their own country, as it became clear during World War II that British rule would be coming to a close for many reasons. And that breakup was exceedingly painful and violent and involved on a huge scale, something like what we saw with the breakup of Yugoslavia, what we came to call ethnic cleansing. And hundreds of thousands of people were slaughtered, Muslims, Hindus, and Sikhs, and millions crossed the borders so that they could live in an area where their own community was in the majority. And this, of course, ran counter to everything Gandhi had preached over his three decades in India, and he lived to see all this. And it's a very tragic ending to this noble career, which, by any account, was responsible for putting the independence struggle on a mass footing. For me, one of the saddest reflections of that is that Gandhi, on several occasions, went to places where he heard that Hindus had been killing Muslims in retaliation for what they thought Muslims had done to Hindus, and as they did so in the most violent and brutal ways, they would shout Mahatma Gandhi Ki Jai, which is Hindi for long live, for glory to Mahatma Gandhi, as if they were fulfilling his wishes, fulfilling the wishes of this exponent of nonviolence by slaughtering their neighbors. And Gandhi said at the time, these Jai shouts, Jai being the glory shouts, stink in my nostrils. It was extraordinarily painful.
And ultimately, though, that was in part the price he paid for being perhaps too protean.
Well, I think that's a fair judgment, but he wouldn't have been Gandhi if he were just a normal political figure, and he wouldn't have had the impact he had. What makes the story, I think, fully tragic.
And even to today, where he is still so revered in the country,
he is the father of the nation.
That rejects so many of his teachings.
Absolutely. and or even surprised to hear about them sometimes. It's I thought my book would be controversial in India because here's a foreigner saying, you know, a lot of people, my book is subtitled Mahatma Gandhi and His Struggle with India. The "with" is supposed to be a little explosive and provocative there. Many people have written books that amount to Mahatma Gandhi and his struggle for India. He certainly struggled for India. But this is about the flip side of that, the ways in which it didn't work. And there are certainly people who think about this in India, and there are certainly people who take the weight of Gandhi's teachings very seriously, but India as a whole has moved on.
Joseph Lilleveld, the book is Great Soul, Mahatma Gandhi and His Struggle with India. Joseph, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Well, thank you. That was excellent. I appreciate it.
Thank you.